No, he's in front of you.
House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Colleagues, we have a busy agenda today, per usual. I want to announce at the beginning that I'm going to hold over House Bill 20, the work session on House Bill 2801 and 2893 to the next meeting on Thursday. House Bill 2048 relating to Sunset on Architectural Paint Stewardship Program, we will not be hearing today. The bill needs more work, and we will bring it up at a later date. And with that, open a public hearing on House Bill 3337. Representatives Garrett and Gilliam, please. Adam, do you want to give us a quick description of the bill while they're coming up?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 3337 adds conservation and maintenance of ecosystems as a goal to the state policy relating to ecosystems and land use. Directs the governor's office with the assistance of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board to review local, state, and federal conservation plans, propose process for alignment of those plans, develop statewide goals for maintenance, enhancement, and restoration of ecosystems, and make all available information available to the public. Encourages state agencies and local governments to adopt programs and conserve or enhance ecosystem services, allows state agencies and local governments to use payments for ecosystem services if compensatory mitigation is used, provides guidelines for compensatory mitigation, requires state agencies and local governments to compare to the extent practical costs related to natural infrastructure as part of or in lieu of development projects and infrastructure, allows state agency to purchase measurable ecological outcomes, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. For the record, Chris Garrett from House District 38. Glad to be here with my esteemed colleague, Representative Gilliam. House Bill 3337 implements recommendations from the Senate Bill 513 work group from 2009 and subsequent discussions with the business community, nonprofit organizations, state agencies, and tribes. Some concerns about the bill have been addressed in the Dash 1 amendment, which softens some of the prescriptive language regarding agency duties. Ecosystem services is the technical term for the goods that we receive from our natural environment, such as clean air and water, fertile soil, flood control, climate regulation, and wildlife habitat. When these goods are degraded or destroyed, they can be expensive or impossible to replace. We all agree that these goods need to be preserved, but traditional approaches to achieving these outcomes have been heavily regulation-based. In some circumstances, market-based approaches where people and businesses can purchase ecosystem services to satisfy duties under Oregon's environmental laws can achieve the same goals through more effective and efficient means. Such market-based approaches give business greater flexibility in complying with environmental rules, rural landowners an additional source of revenue from selling ecosystem services, and environmentalists get assurance that mitigation is effective, and Oregon workers' restoration jobs created by the demand for ecosystem services. The purpose of this bill is to make ecosystem services markets more efficient, effective, and equitable. Oregon has often led the nation in adopting new approaches, and this is another example of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be back in the committee and to see everyone. Thank you for this chance to say a few words about paint stewardship. That's what we're talking about, right? Apparently not.
I see you have not lost your flair for the dramatic.
Thank you. I've been on this bill for quite some time, and I'm still excited about the framework. I appreciate very much my colleagues' comments about what we're trying to do here to move forward what may seem to be opposing viewpoints into a framework where we can actually accomplish something and conserve something. However, I would suggest a couple of things as you move forward, Mr. Chair. I look forward to looking at the Dash 1s more closely, and I apologize if these comments, you know, are covered by that amendment. But I realize we are back to the original bill, I think, in front of us. If that's not correct, you can correct me now.
I dream of no such thing, Representative.
I see. So I think it's important that you all, I'm sure, are working on the fiscal. That's a very important aspect of this. But also, I don't want us to lose the products of the work group, so to speak. My suggestion is, I have two suggestions. One, let's continue on making this a bill that's workable. But let's look at the permissive language. I think you have done that, but I think your work so far ends, if my observation is correct, at Section 5. And Section 6 has a classic shall, may situation that I think should be addressed. So I hope that you will look closely at Section 6 as well, that first line, and change that shall into a may. But mostly, and I can't believe I'm going to suggest this because we've had many conversations about this, Mr. Chair, but I think that perhaps, given the length of this bill's life or purgatory in this building, that we ought to convene another work group, because it's come to my attention that folks may not be talking. I'm not going to add fuel to any rumors, but I do think both sides, all sides, stakeholders need to come together again. I don't believe, and I'm glad to be corrected, there was much conversation between the last session and this session. And we're not quite ready for prime time, but I want to preserve this framework as Representative Garrett outlined it. And my suggestion would be a work group with a goal, in my opinion, of the 14th session to come back and have some of these things hammered out. Communication is absolutely important when you're trying to do something as diverse as this bill tries to do. And those are my suggestions, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the chance to say something.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Fentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a most interesting concept and one with which I'm not yet adequately familiar. Nonetheless, I'm going to ask you this question. The assumption underlying a bill of this nature is that there is a evolution of the state to a point where there should be no more net loss of these environmental services. That's the underlying assumption. My question would be, is it necessary that this state address that assumption in a way that would might bring to all of our attention where exactly we are when it comes to this baseline that we are so willingly accepting? Because the assumption here is that whatever the environmental service, we've already exhausted as much as we possibly can, and thus from this point forward there will be no more net loss. Is that assumption true? And if so, where do we find that out? That's what this bill suggests, or not. And so I need to have your guys' thought on that.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, I don't know that I share that assumption personally. I see this legislation more as an effort to say, take that assumption as is. Take the existing set of environmental goals and objectives as set out in statute as they are. Can we come up with more than one way to get from A to Z? It doesn't always have to be a coercive, regulatory, top-down approach. If we don't even have to answer the question whether the ultimate goal or the assumption is correct, I think to agree that it's worthwhile to promote more flexibility in achieving those outcomes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree totally with the thought of flexibility. What I have seen in any mitigation scenario is an assumption that there's a baseline in place which requires no net loss. And I see this at the back end of the bill, no net loss. But that assumes that we've already spent as much of these environmental services as we can afford to. And that in going forward, every agency has to make sure that whatever it does, it will not spend any more of those resources. There will be mitigation for those resources. There'll be a balancing. The underlying assumption being that we can't spend any more of them. But in order to understand where we are, we need an inventory. The example I've been using, poor though it may be, is that the state of Oregon has a portfolio of these services. And one, in order to measure whether or not we reach the point of not being able to spend any more of them, would have to understand the value, the size, the extent, and the nature of that portfolio. Have we done such a thing? Or are we merely assuming that we've reached the point where everything must now be mitigated? Because that's what this bill suggests. At least I think so. And I'm looking forward to other people's conversation on this because it's kind of one of the most important parts of the device.
Certainly, and I am very open personally to having your suggestion that we revisit those assumptions be part of this conversation, by all means.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We know you're busy and appreciate your time. Given the members we have on the committee and we have a few people that are coming and going, I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3337, open a work session on House Bill 2105. Colleagues, this is a bill that we voted on out of committee about a week and a half ago. Unfortunately, we did not have quite the right motion when we voted for it, and so it has come back to be re-voted on, and we have a somewhat complicated series of motions to make this right. Representative Boone.
Chair Bailey, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2105.
Representative Boone moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2105. This motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the rules are suspended. Representative Boone.
Chair Bailey, I move we reconsider the vote by which 2105 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Boone moves to reconsider the vote by which HB 2105 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. With a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, motion carries.
Chair Bailey, I move House Bill 2105 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request that the subsequent referral to the House Committee on Land Use be rescinded.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 2105 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request that the subsequent referral to the House Committee on Land Use be rescinded. Is there any discussion?
Can I ask why?
We rescinded that at last time. We had a letter from the Speaker's office rescinding it, and as we discussed on the committee last time, that issue for 2105 had been taken care of. So the intention when we passed it out last time was to have that rescinded. We just didn't get the motion to fully rescind it correct last time around. Any further discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Motion carries. All right. And it is headed to the floor. Representative Bence, I believe you were assigned to carry. Is that, am I remembering that correctly?
You know, Mr. Chair, honestly, I don't recall. If so, sure.
We'll have Representative Bence carry 2105 and close the work session on House Bill 2105. And reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3337. Call forward Justin Martin, Sarah Vickerman, and John Chandler, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of Defenders of Wildlife in enthusiastic support of House Bill 3337. With me today is Sarah Vickerman, who is a true expert in conservation outcomes and ecosystem services. So I will be brief in my remarks and make sure that you have a good opportunity to discuss with Sarah the specific bill and language. But I do think it's important that this committee understand the legislative history surrounding this bill and what we've been through over the past 4 years. Initially, Senate Bill 513, in which you have a copy of the executive summary and who was part of that in front of you, created a work group that ultimately created a report that made recommendations to offer legislation in 2011. Senate Bill 513 passed the Senate by a vote of 25-5 in 2009. It passed the House by a vote of 44-12 in 2009. And as you saw earlier from our first panel, it had good bipartisan support, both with Republican and Democratic senators on the Senate side, and Representative Garrett and Representative Gilliam, who are also sponsors again this session. That bill also passed committees in 2011 on the House side and a committee in 2012 on the Senate side. Some of the folks within that work group that you can see on that list there today were part of the process and have been part of that process. And while I'm not advocating their support, I wanted to point out a few of those. Oregon State University, Departments of Forestry, Department of Ag, Fish and Wildlife, several other agencies, the Oregon Farm Bureau, the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, the Oregon Forest Industries Council, the Oregon Home Builders Association, the Grand Ronde Tribe, who I also support, the Port of Portland, Benton County, Wildwood Mahonia, and the Oregon Business Council, just to mention a few. People have been at the table. People have been having those discussions. discussions. And, as always, I have been in the building since 2009. My phone number is the same, and people can see me in here each and every day. And we at Defenders of Wildlife are very open to all kinds of communication. So I want to make sure that people understand that we are willing to have those discussions. Finally, I would say this in closing. While House Bill 3337, Conservation Outcomes and Ecosystem Services, may be difficult concepts to grasp because they are so new, I think it is very telling that this legislation is supported by such a wide array of interests across such a broad political spectrum. This to us is encouraging, and one of the main reasons that the Oregon Legislature can be proud of the work they have done and why you should continue to look towards the future in this arena is because this has the ability to provide positive outcomes for businesses, developers, conservationists, landowners, ratepayers, and most importantly, to all of us as Oregonians. So I would again ask for your support in passage of House Bill 3337, and thank you very much for this opportunity today.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. We'll go to Ms. Vickerman next.
Good afternoon, Chairman Bailey, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. I really appreciate it. This bill promotes outcome-based approaches to conservation policy and the consideration of the full range of nature's benefits and decisions about land management and infrastructure development. It offers flexibility for compliance with existing regulations through alternative pathways that produce better environmental results at a lower cost, and encourages landowners to be rewarded for contributing to state and local conservation goals.
And I'm sorry, Ms. Vickerman, yes. Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm Sarah Vickerman. I'm with Defenders of Wildlife.
Thank you.
Yes, okay. And as Justin mentioned, similar legislation won committee approval in the previous two sessions, one on the House and one on the Senate. And before I get into the specifics, I'd like to thank Representative Bentz for his question and comment when Representative Garrett and Gilliam were up here. I agree with you 100% that the state needs a baseline assessment of ecological conditions and ecosystem services, or however you want to describe them, and that the assumption that there should be no net loss of those is not an assumption that we made either in the work group or in putting this bill together. Because if one really did have a statewide assessment of the conditions of Oregon's ecosystems, then one could make a reasonable decision about which ones have been compromised, perhaps which ones are still available for allocation to other purposes and whatnot. And I wouldn't assume in any way that no net loss is an underpinning or an assumption of this bill. So what the bill does is that it frames this outcome-based approach to environmental policies that should shift over time to a more accountable suite of conservation programs. Because it would require over time, not immediately, because we don't necessarily know how to do this, the measurement of these ecological outcomes. It adds ecosystem services to the guiding principles in Oregon's land use program, but does not require the consideration. It simply encourages the consideration of those services in the land use program. It also encourages, but does not require, the consideration of natural infrastructure options. For example, sometimes restored wetlands or restored stream-sign vegetation can do a better job of improving water quality than expensive engineering solutions that are energy-intensive and have long maintenance costs. A major section in the bill reframes mitigation policies to improve the flexibility and overall effectiveness of these mitigation programs by providing a broader ecological context in which these individual mitigation programs would be carried out. And then, as you mentioned in the bill summary, it directs the governor's office to synthesize existing conservation plans. The Dash 1 amendments, which I believe you have before you, soften some of the language that was inadvertently crept in from an earlier draft of the bill, where it says shall the amendments change the wording to may or should or were feasible, and you can see that. Those amendments were requested by Clean Water Services. I believe you'll hear from them later, and perhaps they'll explain in more detail. Justin explained the background of the bill, so I'll skip that. But you have in your packet some letters of support from a variety of very diverse interests that you can take a look at, including the Oregon Business Council, Oregon Home Builders that you'll hear from Mr. Chandler, Harry and David, and other interests that may derive income from providing these services to the restoration sector and provide employment in this growing field. Other supporters include the Association of Oregon Counties, Clean Water Services, which is Oregon's pioneer in paying landowners for their contribution to improving water quality using natural infrastructure, the Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and the Network of Oregon Watershed Councils have the letter in there, along with quite a few others. So we believe this bill is needed because most environmental laws were passed decades ago to address narrow and specific problems like industrial pollution or unplanned development. They tend to be administered by individual agencies that work in isolation and often duplicate effort or work at cross purposes. So these regulatory programs have been effective in improving water quality and air quality and containing sprawl, but they haven't been updated to reflect some pretty significant changes in economics, ecosystems, and others. This bill will help developers meet current regulatory requirements more efficiently with better results, save tax and take taxpayers and ratepayers money by promoting non-structural solutions. And encourages agencies to provide financial assistance to landowners who manage land and water to achieve specific conservation benefits. Without that assistance, some landowners can't provide those benefits. And finally, I believe you have a fiscal impact statement. The latest one we've seen has $185,000. Change for 0.75 FTE at the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. This position was funded the last biennium and apparently not included in the governor's current budget because of a technical error, and there are efforts underway to do a technical adjustment for that the fiscal impact. So I thank you very much, and welcome John Chandler.
Ms. Vickerman, yes. Well, before Mr. Chandler goes, we have a packet here from you. Mm-hmm. Could you just describe briefly what's in this packet here?
Yes. What's in the packet are about, I think, 28 letters from different agencies and organizations that have been involved in this bill for several years, as Justin mentioned, and who support it for a variety of reasons that you can see by taking a look at the letters. And on the front of the packet are one or two sentence summaries from each of the attached letters, so you can see some of the different points that are made by the people who wrote the letters.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of HB 3337 for, I think, the fourth iteration of this particular idea. Our support for this bill is premised primarily on our deep frustration with the current system we have from a development standpoint of environmental regulations. As Ms. Vickerman indicated, we have a fairly old system that was imposed many years ago, some parts of it dating back to the Nixon administration, if not before, in terms of the Clean Water Act, Environmental Protection Act, and all of that, where it does, over time, has broken down into silos, and you have each silo within its, if it has many silos there, each department of each agency trying to administer their piece of the law and doing so in good faith, doing so with the best of intentions, but the outcome on the ground is oftentimes silly and expensive. And we understand that we have to do things from the development standpoint. We understand we are supposed to leave the site in better or improved condition, at least the same condition as when we found it, but we'd like to do so with as little expense and disruption and as much economic productivity as we can. And what oftentimes happens, for example, is we're required to address stormwater runoff as a matter of the Clean Water Act state policy as well, and oftentimes that involves doing what are called swales, which for those of you who don't speak environmental regulation is really a ditch with stuff growing in it. Normally you don't want stuff growing in a ditch. If it's a swale, you do want stuff growing in it. That's supposed to filter out the pollutants and such as that, and they work really well until they don't work at all. We still have to put them in. Oftentimes they're on a site that doesn't have the capability, soil or grade or something else, and we end up with the engineered solutions, or we end up spending an immense amount of money, and then homeowners association or subsequent purchasers have to then fiddle with it. The much better answer would be to figure out some other way of either allowing that builder to or developer to buy credits in in some other system to allow an off-site use, cleaning up the water someplace else where you get a net environmental benefit, not necessarily site-by-site, lot-by-lot, project-by-project. What this bill would do is not mandatory, but simply allow agencies to think differently about environmental regulation. I had a conversation during the interim on an unrelated matter with one of our environmental agencies, and since they didn't ask to be part of this conversation, I will not name them. But their name rhymes with Z-E-Q. What they were talking about was a water temperature issue. And one of their permit writers said to me they had developed a very interesting approach to a water temperature problem, which would have otherwise cost, I think, roughly $1 billion for the entity that was supposed to cool down water temperatures in this one stream. And they managed to address it by a very sophisticated calculation using tree plantings on the upper reaches of this particular stream and the tributaries to allow more shade so that the temperature of the water was reduced. So when it got to the outfall of this particular installation, the outfall didn't raise the temperature above the TMDL, the total maximum daily load for temperature, so it would be fine. There was no environmental degradation. And the punchline of the story is, had they been sued, they probably would have lost. Because that sort of thinking, sensibly from our standpoint, about environmental benefit, about the most cost-effective way to achieve the outcome, probably wasn't legal. Now, it's gone forward, everybody's happy. This bill would allow those sorts of conversations amongst agencies, between agencies, to come up with ways of addressing environmental needs, environmental regulations, in a way that's cost-effective, sensible, and frankly, in keeping with modern understandings of, as Ms. Vickerman mentioned, environmental science, ecosystems, and so on. So we think it's a good idea. Now, what will happen on the ground as a result of this bill if when you pass it? I don't know. Will it be better than what we've got now? I hope so. I think it would be hard-pressed to be worse, and that means, I mean no insult there to our environmental agencies. They're doing the best they can. This will provide them some additional tools and additional ways to think about things and some permission, more than anything else, to think about things differently than the current system. We recommend it to you. Happy to support it. Be glad to take questions, but do need to get next door to another hearing. So short questions, please.
Is there any only questions for me? I thought I'd get there first. Questions for this panel? Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. So this is very interesting. I've been working on issues in my district, and Representative Rudin has as well, where we're looking at the most cost-effective ways to provide additional sidewalks and streets in our neighborhoods for areas that don't have that. And one of the cost factors that we're running into is the water that's being displaced by paving and some of the costs. So I noticed that there was some language in here about how this would impact local governments. Could you go into that in a little bit more detail?
Yes, the goal is for local governments to consider the full range of options when dealing with construction projects like this, including those natural infrastructure options. So obviously, when you create more impervious surface, you create some increased stormwater issues. And so there are ways like these bioswales that may or may not make sense in any given place, but that can be or restoring a wetland, for example, that might have a much more positive benefit within the watershed itself than doing some little project on the site that really doesn't matter and can't be maintained, and doesn't have long-term benefits, ecological or otherwise, and can be very expensive.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I appreciate the comment that we don't yet have a baseline from which to operate, but I would challenge the assertion that this bill fails to assert or impose upon us the no net loss standard. It's throughout the bill. I mean, every part of the bill assumes that we have already used up that which is usable, and everything that we use from this point forward must be replaced. I draw your attention to the third page of the bill, line 12. Develop statewide goals that support the maintenance, enhancement, and restoration of ecosystem service. Nothing about spending any of them. It's every part of the bill is set up so that you add to that which we have. This is not to suggest that we need to use up our environment without proper care for it. It's to figure out a way of doing it, and there's lots of words in here about doing it efficiently. I would simply point at that which we now are doing, the division of state lands. The cost for an acre of replacement wetland is $79,000. That's the average cost, not the high cost. $79,000. If we impose this standard upon this state and we don't control this monster, we won't be doing anything. Because for $79,000 an acre, we will stall further out, and actions won't happen. There's a spatial requirement here, or a spatial reference. I hope that means space, great big huge space like where I'm from. And the thought that where there's 19 million acres in my district, we would have to spend $79,000 to replace one suggests misallocation of resources. Now, I've said all this, put my fears to rest.
Well, if for the $79,000 figure, in California it's even higher. It can be up over several hundred thousand. And the reason it would be so high would be that the wetland banks are typically within areas that are already fairly developed. Therefore, land is very expensive, as opposed to placing them further out where the land wouldn't be so expensive, so the price wouldn't be higher. So the price is set by the market. It's whatever the market will bear. And in the case of wetland banks in the Willamette Valley, most of them are owned and managed by private landowners who have created the banks and sold the credits to developers and made money on them. So one of the provisions in the bill is to, in the mitigation section, is to allow a service area large enough for these more efficient investments. And so if a service area is large enough to identify the places where these banks would be the most effective and ecologically and the most efficient economically, then perhaps we end up with larger banks at a lower cost per credit with ecological benefits that last longer than some of these that are very small and don't work very well. So and as far as your comment about the goals, Representative Bentz, that would be the point of creating goals. So there, if there are goals around the ecosystem services that the state wants to concentrate on, then obviously we wouldn't develop goals for those services which are either abundant enough to continue to exploit without compensating or offsetting for, or concentrate on the ones where there's clearly a problem, like water quality and water quantity in some of the streams. I mean, that's your earlier point about we haven't done a baseline assessment is such an important one because it's really nobody's job in Oregon to do that. In 2000, the Oregon Progress Board, now defunct, worked with, I believe it was Oregon State University and others, to write a State of the Environment report. And that was the closest we've ever come to doing a statewide assessment of these different attributes, of the state. And we haven't done one since. It's nobody's job to do one. There's no funding to do one. And even though the our ability to do that is now much more sophisticated and potentially lower cost because of the technology, the improved GIS imagery, and the improved capacity of the agencies to do this kind of work, it's really nobody's job. Remember back to the silos? Every agency has a limited scope, of their interest, and so they end up with say, forestry and fish and wildlife and others, maybe duplicating effort and unnecessarily spending money, whereas if we efficiently spent the money we now spend on these assessments to do a more coordinated and consistent one, we'd have much better information upon which to put these things in place, like innovative solutions and alternative paths and, all that other sort of stuff. In the absence of doing that, you're really just fumbling around.
I know Mr. Chandler wants to get a comment in here. Let me ask, though, before you do that, is there anything in this bill that would require an entity to engage in an expensive mitigation project or ecosystem service project outside what they might already engage in if it was less cost-effective to do so?
No, this doesn't require anybody to do anything. They don't have to do otherwise. It just potentially encourages the agencies administering the agencies or local governments administering the program to think about it in a little bit different way. And so most of the language in the bill is deliberately permissive, and with the -1 amendments, it's, mostly permissive to just think about new ways of doing things. And then I would expect that if this is implemented in the way that we hope, that the agencies will come back to the legislature at a later date with greater specificity about how this can be implemented.
Ms. Chandler?
Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Bence's comment on the global side, my interest in the bill, as I indicated, is on the specific. We're looking at this site by when we get requirements on a project-by-project basis. But wetlands is a good example, probably even better than the stormwater one I used, that if we have to mitigate a wetland site and do it on-site or adjacent, oftentimes it's not a good quality wetland. It's going to fail. There's no one in charge of maintaining it. And we will have spent a bunch of money from the developer's standpoint without achieving any environmental benefit other than to get the permit and get through the immediate regulatory hoop. Our hope is a bill like this would allow us to take the same money we would have spent on the mitigation and pay into a fund that could create a Jackson Bottom, to create a better functioning wetland with herons and fish and such as that in it, so you don't just get something that turns into a mud bog over time unattended. With regard to the specific example, Representative Bence, of the price for wetlands set in the state, there is another bill floating through the system that I should mention. I don't recall the number off the top of my head, where DSL is trying to, would ask for authority to charge by region so that wetlands in your district would not be paying the same price for mitigation as wetlands in inside the metro area, for example. That might get to the example you used of costing.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't see him in the room, but can you tell me why Water Watch would be against this bill?
We could probably have a follow-up with Water Watch on that, Representative. I believe they've submitted testimony.
Well, my point is that we've heard from really both sides of this now that are opposed, and so it's just unexpected.
We've had, Representative Boone, we've had extensive conversations with Water Watch and offered on numerous occasions to consider alternative language that they might have to it. And I think that, and I won't speak for them, not my job, but I think that much of their concern stems from the fact that the bill is, it creates a framework within which agencies can be innovative. And they really don't want agencies to be innovative. They want the everything to be very clearly spelled out and prescriptive, so that they, you know, can tell whether the agencies are following it or not. And our view of it is a little bit different, in that we think there are better ways to do business, and that if we don't give the agencies a little bit of encouragement and room to maneuver to find better ways, that they won't. And this and for people that want to experiment, then this, you know, gives them the opportunity to try some new things.
One more, Representative Bence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. I do appreciate it. I would suggest that Section 6, as I think Representative Gilliam referenced, imposes a mandatory obligation upon all state agencies to the greatest extent practicable undertake programs and projects which, and it walks down through this, the exact things we're talking about. And this means that anything that a state agency is doing must fit within that which this bill suggests happen. Would you disagree?
To the fullest extent practical leaves them a lot of room to maneuver, but what it's trying to do here is to encourage them to take a broader view and place these, you know, make these decisions within a context that goes beyond the individual site, as Mr. Chandler mentioned.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chandler, I appreciate your, kumbaya spirit on this bill. And I think it's well-intentioned, and obviously I think we do long for some flexibility on some guidelines and regulations that can be a bit burdensome and troublesome for those of us in the industry, but could it not also be true that the lack of specificity in the bill could lead to further implementation at some point in time that could perhaps be less favorable than what we have right now, with those unforeseens to comes in here? I mean, it's a little broadly written, as I would say, and I think you probably agree.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that is a concern. Obviously reasonable minds can look at the same issue and differ. The conclusion that we've come to on this is that it takes some doing to get worse, frankly. Not out of malice, but simply out of disconnectedness, and that better outcomes, particularly working with a group like Defenders, or being able to demonstrate some better environmental outcomes, is probably preferable to fighting with the environmental groups over the whether or not you jot and tittled your way through the rules as they're currently written. But absolutely it's a risk, and it's something that we'd be monitoring and be involved with from a policy standpoint going forward, should the bill move forward, to make sure that agencies took this and implemented it in the spirit in which it's intended. intended of creativity, cooperation, better outcomes, not an excuse to dream up more regulations. Not that they would, of course, but hypothetically.
Representative Denbrough.
Thanks, Chair Bailey. So the bill, as I read it now, is largely aspirational, right? And I applaud those aspirations. I'm wondering what you're thinking about in terms of accountability to see, you know, follow-up reporting. Do you envision some sort of regular reporting to the legislature of, you know, giving us a status report? Are we moving forward here? You know, are we meeting those aspirations?
It's a very interesting question. I think it would be very helpful for the to get a report at some reasonable interval, every couple of years, every 5 years, on how the agencies are dealing with the requirements.
Yes, just follow up. I don't know how you would do that, but I think that would be very useful for us here before we would entertain next steps on any of these.
Senate Bill 513 established a work group that required a report to the legislature. And the work group did that. So I guess the trick there would be to identify the entity that would be responsible for writing the report, because you would want the report in the spirit of the cross-agency nature of the bill. You would want the report to draw from the experiences of different agencies and deal with some of the questions about how the agencies are making more efficient use of resources and working together better would be a really helpful thing, actually. Good idea. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Just call up Bruce Roll, Chris Jarmer, and Ian Tollison, please. Whoever would like to start.
First.
I'm going to get started.
Please. Thank you, Chair Bailey, committee members. My name is Bruce Roll. I'm the Director of Watershed Management at Clean Water Services, public utility in Hillsboro, Oregon. I come before you today more as a practitioner, someone who's been doing this trading stuff for almost 10 years now. Worked for utilities on the East Coast, worked for utilities in Colorado, and now I'm blessed with being here in Oregon. So my comments are geared toward how does a utility view it, and how does it work within the real-world settings? What does it look like on the ground? What are the things that happen? If you're not familiar with Clean Water Services, we're a regional utility outside of Hillsboro that services Washington County. We've been in the trading business since 2004. We were awarded the nation's first watershed-based permit that allowed for trading, temperature trading, in the Tualatin. Over the last almost 10 years now, we've evolved into the nation's largest temperature trading program, and probably the largest certainly in the world in terms of temperature trading. It's been hugely, hugely successful. It's saved us over $100 million to date, and those savings continue to increase as we do more within the basin. In terms of results, water quality trading has allowed us to do a number of things, not only actions on the ground, but to leverage other monies and enhance our partnerships with local farmers as well as our communities that are in the Tualatin Basin. To date, we've done almost 60 miles of riparian corridor restored. Phenomenal numbers when you consider that we're planting at a rate of anywhere from 500 to 700,000 native trees and shrubs annually in the basin. It's like a squirrel going from Hillsboro down to the coast, never touching the ground, and then coming back the other side of the road. So it's been a phenomenal amount of riparian restoration that's occurred in the basin. I think the other reasons it's been successful is we looked at how does it need to be set down within the community. So a lot of utilities like to have a lot of control. Clean Water Services took the model of let's work with the communities. So we went out, worked in the case of agriculture with the conservation districts, NRCS, helped leverage the federal monies from CREP as well as other monies for irrigation efficiency, as well as wetland enhancement. And collectively, with our shade credit and those programs, we're able to put in place one of the most successful voluntary ag programs in the state. And that allows a farmer
farmer to enroll in the program, have a water quality plan, look at potential irrigation efficiency, wetland enhancement, shade credit, and all those things in one package. Been hugely successful. Had over 50 farmers sign up for these programs. We got a waiting list. Can't put them down as fast as I'd like to. Been very, very successful. I think the other piece that's been very successful is it's made a big difference in terms of how the farmers view the importance of stewardship and these actions on their land. In the cities, another great story. We've had over 50,000 volunteer hours as we plant open space and parks areas throughout the county. It's been hugely successful. In the case of the cities, we partner with the 12 cities that are in our service district, as well as a number of nonprofits like Solve, Friends of Trees, and others that muster the volunteers and do our plantings in the urban areas. Like the ag, we've done, I think, around a little over 30, 32 miles in ag, and close to that same number in the urban areas. So now you're going to ask me, well, why is it successful? This is Bruce Take on why it's successful. One, and this is having worked in Maine and Colorado, Oregon and the Northwest are unique in that they're willing to test these types of programs. I could have never done this in Maine. I could have never done it in Colorado. It's just because of the willingness in Oregon to test these things, the flexibility that the agencies have allowed us in putting these programs has been a big piece of it. The other is I can't soften and I can't praise more than I can the importance of creating the partnerships with the community members that helped us implement it in the ag. The other piece that I think is great is it's not just Clean Water Services going out, but we're bringing these partners, and with them we're bringing, and to date, millions of dollars in federal money that come to fund the other elements of the program and the ag program. And we're leveraging all of the great monies that were spent on open space and parks in the urban areas and able to go into those areas and plant and restore and maintain those areas for our shade credit. So it's been a win-win for parks. It's been a win-win for the agricultural people. The term ecosystem services, you know, is somewhat difficult. It's hard to wrap a head around it. I think that, you know, my way of thinking about it is, you know, we all have these natural resources we all learned about in grade school, water and good soil and plants. And, I, you know, for me, it's as simple as looking at how do we enhance the benefits they provide across a broad spectrum. We utilize temperature as one venue to bring that out and to enhance not just the habitat for salmon, but to create buffers for agricultural areas that deal with pesticides and nutrients. We looked at flood attenuation in the urban setting, roughening of the banks that help with flood attenuation, purification of the water. So multi-objectives can be met with some of these trading programs, and I'm here to continue to support those types of programs.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. Chris Strummer, Oregon Forest Industries Council. We in fact did testify in support in 2009 of the original Senate Bill 513. We participated on the work group as well. And at the beginning of that, I made a reference to a couple of things that I consider facts. One of the facts is that we don't get to share in his $100 million. We don't see any of the money out there. The concept of additionality has been tossed about around about quite a few times, and that's essentially if you don't do more than the regulation requires, you're not eligible for these ecosystem service payments. And so the fact that there isn't a lot of private money in these markets is still true, and our members aren't seeing any of that revenue that other people can see because of the concept of additionality. And I mentioned at the time that that's a tough nut to crack. I don't know how we get there, but if we can't get there and we have to sit on the sidelines all the time, that's kind of a problem for us. We're pretty proud of the ecosystem services that we already provide, wildlife habitat and the clean water. And I think without cracking that nut, we'll be on the sidelines permanently. So having said that, this concept is a great concept. Who wouldn't want to be for more efficient and better environmental outcomes? We certainly are. And so we support the concept still. I put on my sheet that I'm neutral on the bill because I have to admit, I don't understand the way the thing is permissively written to the point where it could mean virtually anything to everybody. And I just to point out a couple of things that on particular, on the first page, it says provide disincentives. That's one of the more clear terms in the bill, and that seems pretty bad to be negative. And I know Sarah and Justin would be happy to take that word out, but the concept that there's kind of, you know, something bad out there and we need to make sure people don't do that, maybe that's true in some areas, but we don't think it's true in forestry, and it's not clear whether it applies everywhere to everybody or in only a few circumstances. So the last thing I'll say is in Section 6, it's been brought up before, the permissive language wasn't inserted in there, and I think that was the intent, so that was probably an oversight. But I would say that it's difficult for us to understand what's going to come about. In my case, the regulators, the Department of Forestry, we don't know if the Department of Forestry has a state conservation plan. We don't know what that term means. And below that, on line 8, we're supposed to ensure long-term environmental stewardship. Those are just examples of things that have meaning to some people, and they're probably all well-intentioned, but it's not clear that that's going to mean the same thing to me as a landowner versus a regulator. So it's that kind of stuff that we'd be happy to help try to figure out a way to get the language right. So look forward to working with the group, if there is one.
Tolleson. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, Ian Tolleson with Oregon Farm Bureau. I would have to agree with a lot of the comments made by Chris. Section 6 that Representative Bentz brought up, it appears to us that it will force all state agencies into that criteria. So we don't know what that will entirely mean, costs, implications. So I think there could still be work done with that. I think it is a lofty goal that we're trying to get after, and we are nearly there. However, with maybe a final push with bringing folks to the table, maybe we can get something really ready to go with a clear pathway in the 14th session. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jarmer, you mentioned, and I see it here, Senate Bill 513 Working Group. You were a member of that working group. Is that correct?
Indeed.
And was there a similar bill? There was a bill in 2009. Was there a similar bill in 2011?
So, Mr. Chair, thanks for the question. The work group produced a report which spawned an effort, House Bill 3109, I believe, in 2011, which had essentially the same language as this bill this year. That bill got out of committee, was amended once, but didn't get any further. Senate Bill 1512 in 2012 picked up that amended language and tried to move the ball forward again, and it didn't. And now we're back with the original language in this bill.
And what was your organization's position on 3109?
We didn't take a position in 2011, and I would go back to my protocol is bad here, Mr. Chair. Sorry. Maybe the saying is the wind's kind of out of our sails on this. The ecosystem service market has been drummed up as an alternative to generate revenue for landowners for some time now. And we're still supportive of the concept, but I don't think any of our landowners have actually realized any financial return. So it's difficult to get excited about the concept when the promised payoff doesn't appear.
I'll just ask you bluntly, somebody from your organization told me that you had not been consulted or involved on this bill, given that you were involved in 2009, involved in 2011, part of the work group, and here now during this session. Do you think that's an accurate statement?
Mr. Chair, I do. We heard about the draft, the Dash 1 amendments on Monday afternoon from another group. So I understand what Justin said. I think what he said was true. It's not our bill. We're not pushing it. And I would assert that if somebody wants our help with the bill, they should give us a call. I think that's fair.
And or perhaps involve you on a work group.
And I would be happy to do that, yes.
And clearly you have been happy to do that because you were on one. Mr. Tolleson, I'm curious. Are you new with the Farm Bureau?
Chair Bailey, yes. My tenure is of 3 months. Thank you.
Okay. And your organization was involved with this bill in prior sessions?
Chair Bailey, yeah, my understanding talking with Katie is she was involved initially in the beginning in 2009 and has since then kind of, for whatever reasons, hasn't been actively engaged, and certainly no involvement prior to session working the bill or any possible amendment.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Call forward Marion Haynes, Bruce Anderson, and Roger Beyer, please. Ms. Haynes.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Marion Haynes. I'm with Portland General Electric. I guess I'd like to begin by agreeing with some of what we've heard from folks that seem to be on both sides of this issue. I think that we see value conceptually in an ecosystem services model that would provide some flexibility. Our experience with mitigation, and we do this a lot, is that sometimes doing on-site or looking for those like-kind of properties does not result in the best ecological outcomes. I also agree that there are silos within the current system, and that flexibility could be helpful going forward. So conceptually, we think that there's a lot of value in pursuing this. Implementing something like this is where a lot of complexity gets brought in. As a developer, while we like flexibility, we also need certainty. And so the permissive language in this bill as it's drafted right now, well, that's a good thing in some ways. How does that work with existing requirements for mitigation that we have to undertake currently? We have a lot of projects that we're working on now and are looking at how we'll be mitigating for things as complicated as a, you know, potential transmission line that will cross different counties throughout the state. We have federal obligations to meet. We have state obligations to meet. And it's unclear to us how this would interact with those things, whether it could be additive on top of that. It's not clear whether you could choose a, you know, path A or path B and not have to, you know, deal with requirements under both paths. The bill doesn't change any statutory requirements that different agencies have related to mitigation. So, you know, it's permissive, but again, it's unclear whether they'll be able to take that path and whether that would satisfy an obligation that we have under existing state and federal laws when we're mitigating for projects. So, again, we'd be happy to sit down with folks and talk about the language. You know, seems to us a fairly high-level discussion about this. We're much more on the ground doing projects, nuts and bolts is the way that we're kind of approaching this and looking at the language, and it raises some questions. So again, we think conceptually there's a lot to offer, how we implement it and what the words look like and how it relates to existing laws we think needs a little further refinement. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce Anderson with Northwest Natural. I want to just quickly say a couple of things. First, Northwest Natural does have a record of supporting environmental protection and restoration as we've installed and improved our system and support the protection of the environment in the course of our business operations and energy facility siting process. We've also been working with the Governor's Office on some of their mitigation legislation. We do have some concerns with the bill, given some of the broad language in terms, as you've heard already on that. We do support mitigation and flexibility in accomplishing our work, and would like to look forward to working with the proponents of the bill to see if we can maybe clear up some of the questions and concerns. So appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing multiple clients. As you see on the list, I did not list the clients, and I did not list if I was for or against. Quite honestly, I don't know if I'm for or against. I have at least four different clients who are interested and or concerned about this bill. You've heard much of the interest and the concern expressed by other witnesses. I would reiterate, Section 6 seems very concerning, particularly as specific agricultural interests, if they are interested, for instance, in building a storage reservoir for irrigation purposes. and state agencies shall, not may, but shall, implement in their duties to the greatest extent practical, undertake projects and programs that are consistent with any statewide conservation plans first, long-term environmental stewardship second, address multiple conservation values. I don't need to read this, the whole wording to you, but you understand the first four issues in that shall section are all conservation goals or environmental stewardship goals, nothing to talk about production or irrigation or profit or how to get water on land and create jobs in the state of Oregon. So it may work. We don't know if it'll work. And so that's my concern, or that my client's concerns on that section specifically. Section 7.
Mr. Barrett, could you say who your clients are again?
My clients in this bill or in general will be
on
the
Seed bill.
Council, Oregon Berry, Blueberry Growers, the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and the Oregon Dairy Farmers.
Thank you.
Therefore, Section 7, does this section allow the state agency to purchase mitigation credits? It says they may purchase measurable ecological outcomes. I'm not sure what that means, but I think it means they're going to become the banker. State agencies are going to become the banker for these mitigation credits. Does that mean the state agencies get to decide who they purchase from, who they sell them to, and do they get to set the price for these credits? I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know, it's not defined in the bill. I'd also point out that I thought the person from Clean Water Services who testified before us, they got a great a resume as to why this bill isn't needed. He discussed that they're the nation's largest temperature trading agency. They have done 60 miles of streamside restoration. It's a voluntary program, more than 50 farmers involved, more than 50,000 city volunteers involved, done 30-plus miles of restorations in both cities and on farms, and it's all been done without this bill. So that brought to my mind, why do we need the bill? So, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to entertain the discussion with the proponents, and maybe some of the questions can be answered. Maybe it'd be a great thing for my clients, and they would all support it. I just can't tell by the language of the bill. With that, I'd be happy answering questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Ms. Haynes, Mr. Anderson, did either of your companies take a position on any of the previous bills, 3109 or the original Senate Bill 513?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, no, we did not in the either 2011 or 2012 sessions. I do not believe we did in 2009, but that was prior to my time at the company.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd have to echo what Ms. Haynes said and beg ignorance on some of that. I don't believe we took positions on either 2011 or 2012 legislation, but I'd have to check and get back to you on that, sir.
Okay, thank you. Additional questions? Okay, thank you very much for this panel. Jim Welsh, Richard Kosasen, please.
You want to go last?
I don't know, whatever your preference.
Mr. Welsh, please.
Chair Bailey, Jim Welsh, representing the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. In 2012, we gave testimony opposing the proposed legislation. And today we did not make a preference on the sign-up sheet at this point in time. We have some observations on the legislation. We requested, though, in 2012 that there be a work group put together again, because we weren't on the first work group. And we heard testimony that in 2012 that this program would be certainly a benefit to landowners. And not only am I representing landowners, but these are individual business people, sometimes corporations, but they are small businesses, but they are really doing business on a lot of acreage, something over 6 million acres in this state, very much involved in ecosystem programs in restoration and enhancement, and have been for years. And I guess at this point in time, we would be supportive of one of the sponsors' request in possibly putting together again a work group to try to work together and get this right. Because there has not been a similar work group addressing this issue since the first time before the 2012 or 2011 session. And we would like to participate, especially if it's supposed to be so good for landowners and business people. This bill elevates enhancement of ecosystem services over other priorities, such that agencies may be required to do more than merely mitigate impacts to ecosystem services, but rather may be required to implement programs to enhance them. And I must say that we do have two programs in existence today under existing law that allow some trading, some things that we're talking about in 3337. Under ORS 468B555, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality is authorized to develop and maintain a pollutant reduction trading program to achieve water quality. And under ORS 196.615-620, the Department of State Lands administers Wetlands Mitigation Bank credit trading programs to comply with state permits and enhance wetland resources. So we already have some things that have been used, and as we heard already today in the state, some of this has been very successful. So you have to ask, is this bill, as we see today, needed? And today, only DEQ and state lands, as I understand, the two agencies involved at this point in time. We'd like to point out that there are three things that we are concerned with, and that is ecosystem services markets should be prohibited from making. We want to make sure they are not going to undermine local economies as they exist today. Secondly, the mitigation credit price for a given project should not exceed the cost to mitigate for the project. And thirdly, a specification of who will pay for costs related to verification, monitoring, and inspection of mitigation credits. As this bill kind of sets things up, it really is a government program. And today we have markets that are not government programs. We have certainly legislation sometimes that allows for certain markets, but this particular bill we're worried about being more government overriding program that would interfere with current markets, and we do have a definite concern there. And having heard that there is successful markets out there with this type of, without this type of legislation, we would say that very possibly we need to go in that direction that is already occurring and stay with several of the state agencies that are already implementing some of these. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Welsh. And I haven't always agreed with all of your positions on this. I appreciate your consistency in your engagement on this issue. Mr. Kosis.
Mr. Chair, Richard Kosasan on behalf of Water for Life. Very briefly, I think I would like to echo some comments made by Roger Beyer in terms of, I think, lack of clarity and undefined terms in the current proposed measure. But I encourage the committee to take a look at the initial definition that was started in 2007 with the passage of House Bill 2293 dealing with the Forest Resource Trust, and it defined ecosystem services, meaning the environmental benefits arising from the conservation and management of forest land, including but not limited to fish and wildlife habitat, clean water and air, pollination, mitigation of environmental hazards, control of pests and diseases, carbon sequestration, avoidance of carbon dioxide emissions, and maintenance of soil productivity. Then we return to Senate Bill 513, addressed by the Legislative Assembly in 2009. We change the definition to ecosystem services means the benefits that human communities enjoy as a result of natural processes and biological diversity. I don't really understand that definition. So we had 2007, 2009, 2011, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, House Bill 3109 was under consideration. It was not affirmatively acted on by the Assembly. In 2012, we addressed the issue with provisions contained in Senate Bill 1511. Specifically with respect to the current proposal before you, I think the terminology that's missing in the bill is something along the lines of balanced use or balanced management of the resource. We've interjected the terminology of restoration, which to me, you restore something to its natural condition absent of human activity. That could be one definition, but the bill fails to define what extent we would go to in terms of any restoration level. The other concerns, I think, with the bill, this could be said, I guess the devils are in the details, and I think the current proposal needs some more details. But we look at provisions contained in Section 3 in terms of facilitating a review of relevant local, state, regional, federal conservation plans that could impact ecosystem services. To me, we're getting the cart in front of the pony, so to speak, and maybe that evaluation and review should be conducted before we move forward on this legislation. Concerns associated with provisions contained in Sections 4 and 5. We basically infer that we're going to set up a mitigation bank, but who holds the credits to the bank? And how is the market set for those individual credits? Finally, Mr. Chair, Section 7. Section 7 states a state agency may purchase measurable ecological outcomes. I have no idea what that refers to, means, or could be construed to represent in future years. Again, you get back to the mitigation bank. Who holds the credits and the market value of those credits? I think you need to consider before you move forward. I think the other consideration, Mr. Chair and members, would be there are a number of proposals floating around the current session in terms of mitigation banking and the topic area of compensatory mitigation. And I think this should be part and parcel with the discussion of other bills, so there is some coordination of the concepts and where we go with this overarching concept in future years. With that, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate it. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3337? Seeing none. Colleagues, I would simply note this is a permissive bill, and it has been worked, and it has been studied. I'm interested now to see a lot of the same groups that complain about regulation that are up here opposing the bill because they can't get past labels and are interested now in supporting regulation. I have heard the call for a task force on this and a work group. We'll be open to considering that. We'll have that discussion on this committee. But I will want to see some evidence that any work that we put into this bill will actually have outcomes that won't involve foot dragging or perhaps knuckle dragging on the issue of ecosystem services. So we will continue to discuss this bill, but the path forward, I think, is there for a cheaper, permissive, and better outcome for developers and for the environment and for our economy. And I'll look forward to this committee taking up the issue. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3337. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2266. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2266 allows the Public Utility Commission to set by rule filing dates for public utility budget documents, clarifies which regulations are related to water utilities.
Mr. Eisdorfer.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Director of the Utility Program at the Public Utility Commission. I'm here to talk about House Bill 2266, which is a modest housekeeping bill in pursuit of better utility regulation. To our knowledge, at this point anyway, there is no opposition to the bill. My written testimony is in front of you, but I really just wanted to make touch on a couple of highlights. The bill does two things. The first is it removes statutory deadlines for two financial reports from the utilities that utilities have to make, and replaces those statutory deadlines with a date to be prescribed by commission rule. And the reason for this is that legitimately utilities sometimes do not have access to the information by the times of those statutory deadlines for those reports. One is the budget of expenditures, the other is an annual financial report. And the Public Utility Commission technically cannot waive that filing deadline because it is in statute. And so by putting the filing dates in rule, the PUC can grant a waiver of that deadline for good cause. I think that it enables utilities to meet the deadlines in a timely manner, but be technically correct at the same time. The second thing it does in Section 4 is really quite simply to add three references to ORS sections to further clarify the difference between service-regulated and rate-regulated water utilities. These are generally small, privately owned water companies. These are not municipal water utilities. We're constantly scrubbing the statutes and to make them work as well for the regulator and the utility and the customers. And this, what I would consider a modest housekeeping bill, just tries to clean up some of those statutes.
Thank you.
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Committee, there's no one else signed up on this bill, so if you got them, fire them now. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Eisdorfer.
Thank
appreciate
you very much.
This. All right. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2266. Colleagues, it will be coming back soon, so
thank
look
you.
At it and let me know what you're thinking on it. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3103. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 3103 exempts marinas or public fueling stations from the definition of facility as it relates to oil or hazardous material spillage. There is a -1 amendment attached. The -1 amendment replaces the measure, modifies the definition of facility, exempts marinas or public fueling stations from the definition of facility as it relates to oil spills, applies rules related to oil or hazardous material spillage to liquefied natural gas being transferred by or by vessel or facility.
Scott Smith, Palmer Mason, and Sue Marshall, please. Mason.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the Government Relations Manager with the Department of Environmental Quality. I have here with me Scott Smith. He is one of our oil planning planners, oil spill planners at DEQ. We're here to talk about House Bill 3103 and also the -1 amendment that the committee has. DEQ's oil spill planning standards have been in effect in Oregon since 1991. These rules are intended to ensure that the bulk oil terminals and large ships carrying petroleum are safely managing our oil, and if spills should occur, that the industry responds swiftly and effectively to prevent environmental damage. The our rules specifically require all facilities to store or transport 10,000 gallons of petroleum over state waters to submit oil contingency plans, as well as meet training and oil spill drill requirements. Based on the original statute, our rules exclude smaller fueling operations such as public marinas, which pose less of a threat to the environment. Since Oregon has not had any bulk petroleum export operations in the past, the law was crafted to apply only to oil which was received during a transfer. In other words, our rules are limited to the transfer of petroleum from vessels to shore-based facility. This allowed the rules to exempt public marinas and smaller fueling operations. However, there's been recent changes in the energy market, and a facility has started exporting crude oil on the Columbia River from Clascanine, Oregon. This issue is going to get more urgent as additional export facilities are brought online. So I think, again, to kind of recap, the issue here is our rules currently cover the movement of petroleum from vessels to shore, but we don't have the ability to require oil spill planning requirements for petroleum product that's moving from shore to ship. That's the gap in our rules, and require this statutory change, and that's why the bill was filed, and the Dash 1 amendment is just simply to clarify that. And again, I think the committee can appreciate, whether you're talking ship to shore or shore to ship, the risk of spill is the same, the risk of potential damage is the same. The bill and the amendment also bring in liquefied natural gas. Liquefied natural gas in bulk has been regulated since 2007, and the Dash 1 amendment is intended to provide the same equality for any future LNG import-export operations. And I should note for the committee that the Dash 1 amendment would continue to exclude public marinas and smaller fueling operations from these oil spill planning rules. And that, Chair, is the amendment.
Thank you. Mr. Smith?
My name is Scott Smith, and I'm simply here to answer any technical questions that you have. I'm DEQ's oil spill contingency planner.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Marshall.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing Willamette Riverkeeper. Willamette Riverkeeper supports House Bill 3103, which extends oil spill contingency planning standards to operations where oil is transferred from land-based facility to a ship. Current laws regulate only transfers from ship to shore. When the oil spill planning laws were originally enacted in 1991, the state had not envisioned that we would be exporting petroleum or liquid natural gas. Energy markets have changed. They're changing. We're aware of the new facility on the Columbia River that's exporting crude oil. Prior to any further expansions in petroleum exporting facilities, we believe it's important to apply the same regulations both to importers and exporters equally. The risk doesn't change depending on the direction of the flow. The bill provides for reasonable exclusions for smaller fueling operations, and thank you for your consideration, and we encourage your support of this bill.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mason?
Yes, Chair, if I may, members of the committee, there is one change that is required to be made to the Dash 1 amendment. I don't know if the committee happens to have the amendment in front of them.
Page 2, perhaps.
Yes, that would be the page. Page 2, line 18. If you read there, it talks about that transfers oil through navigable waters. That needs to read transfers oil over navigable waters. And that's important because we have vessels that in a separate section of the statute are actually traveling through navigable waters, and we don't want to confuse this language with that other section of law. So it's important that we actually add the word over.
So we'll be expecting a Dash 2.
Yes.
Any other questions?
Just background, I had no idea that we exported crude oil from Oregon. Has there been some find of oil that's
east?
Where did it come from?
I'm guessing point
Please.
East.
Chair Bailey and committee, a facility has opened up in Clatskanie, which is currently exporting crude oil from North Dakota, the Bakken, the Bakken crude up there. They bring in rail cars of around 100 petroleum-filled rail cars, which each hold 28,000 gallons per rail car. Then three trains are required to have enough to fill the barge for transfer. So it's a total of 8.4 million gallons of crude oil that's going from facility to ship at this one facility. And that happened on the first or second week of December when that came online.
How often would they do this?
I believe that the scale of their operations right now is several times a month, two or three times a month. They intend to, you know, export as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do our neighbors to the north, Washington, have similar agency oversight of this? Obviously, that navigable water we're talking about, we kind of share jurisdiction of and upkeep. What kind of regulations does Washington currently have in effect?
Washington Department of Ecology has equal regulations. They go farther in some areas, but all of us, because of Open 90, Oil Pollution Act of 1990, as a result of the Exxon Valdez, all coastal states have regulations such as these.
Please. Chair, this is additional information, Representative Johnson. I think what's also important here is we feel like this is an important issue because our state requirements exceed the federal requirements. EPA simply requires that a facility have a private contractor available should a spill occur, whereas we require actual placement of booms at the facility that can be quickly staged to contain the oil. We also require more drills and training than EPA does for facilities here in Oregon.
One follow-up, please.
One more. To hear, just to confirm, you did say that marinas, I have a marina on the Columbia and so forth, they would not fall under these new regulations, even though the dashed one still call out a marina or a public fueling station?
So, Chair Bailey, Representative Johnson, that is correct. Marinas would be excluded from these oil spill planning requirements. And if you go to page 3 mm-hmm. of the dash 1, and also, Representative Johnson, the dash 2 will preserve this. We're just going to change that one word for the dash 2. And you go up to lines 1 through 4. You can see that that's the exclusion for marinas.
Okay.
And I can add that marinas may also be excluded because they commonly have less than 10,000 gallons. So there's the first chance for exclusion there, but the second chance is that they're directly excluded if they sell the final product to be used.
Thank you. All right, seeing no further questions, I guess I would just say if you could say ship to shore, shore to ship three times fast, that would be
please
great.
Please do that. Not today, not at 4:30.
Is there anybody else who'd wish to testify on House Bill 3103? Okay, seeing none. Close public hearing on House Bill 3103. Anything else for the good of the order? Committee is adjourned.